Yes, Steve. Give you a little introduction to who we are. We're an organization called Hazardous Materials Training and Research Institute. We've worked with EPA since the beginning of what was called the Brownfields program. I'm not sure if you're familiar with Brownfields, but we all across the country, of course, the Brownfields. The training program started in really the early 90s, so it's been going for quite a while. And every year they have competition. They award 10 or 12 competitive grants of ranges 200,000 to 300,000. Now it's for a three-year period. And these are for training environmental positions for people who would go to work in the community. Again, the target group that they're recruiting from are disenfranchised people, whether they're unemployed, disabled, they may be tribal populations with having difficulty finding employment. So they're a diverse population, pretty much the kind you work with. And HMTRI has been working with EPA, not that we ourselves have a training program, but we help training programs with, try to facilitate their programs. We have a conference every year in Alexandria, and in fact, Glow's on the line. Do you want to explain the conference, Glow?
Yeah, this is a conference we bring together all of the EPA-funded grantees, whether they're currently working on money or they've worked on money in the past. It doesn't matter if they're new or old grantees. Everyone is invited. Once you've been funded, they can attend this meeting. And it's a lot of networking, so that the grantees can learn from the other grantees. The other big entity that's there is EPA. We've got a ton of people from headquarters there and at least one person from every EPA region, so that the grantees can then sit with grantees from their region and their EPA project officer. And all of the people, when they register, they give me suggestions of what they want to talk about, and we make those into small group sessions so that they can have small, intimate conversations and get the answers that they need to build a successful program. We do this every year. This year is going to be on October 1st and 2nd. We always have it in the D.C. area, so it's easy access for headquarters to attend. What else, Mike?
Well, there's no cost, and generally, if you don't have
no
a grant,
cost, yeah, that's a biggie.
You have to,
no
you
cost,
have to
and
conference.
We will pay for your hotel for two nights. So
now, generally, it's all of the grantees are invited to this, but for people who attend our PLCs regularly, we also invite them to come along. Also, if someone is interested in really involved in environmental training, and they might be interested in getting into one of these programs or starting a program without this federal grant money, we'd like to have them involved. And what we do is we try to have people who have programs well established mentor those who are trying to establish programs or don't have one yet. We try to exchange information. The main thing is pretty much what you're talking about is trying to exchange information, what works, what people have tried, what organizations perhaps they've gone after for funding to keep themselves sustainable, how they leverage their resources and that type of thing. So it's something you may want to keep in mind. Our objective in all of this, we, as I said, we don't have a program ourselves. We've got a we're associated with community colleges and have developed a knowledge base with National Science Foundation and with EPA in terms of how to starting these programs, sustaining them, curriculum, recruitment, working with different diverse groups. So we kind of work as a coaching group to all of these. We've had over 100 of these programs. Thousands of people have gone through these Brownfields programs. Generally, the classes are usually about 20 people, and they'll have three or four cycles during the course of the grant. So they may be placing 100 or 200 people, depending on the program. Some are linked with construction programs. Some, as yours, it sounds like, are linked to hazardous materials training. We work closely with NIEHS and the hazardous waste worker training program. Now, what happens with the Brownfields grant money that comes out of Washington about every November or so, and this year it was delayed, they come out with an RFP, request for proposals to be submitted, and they give about $3 million out to about 12 programs. And Glo, didn't you get a response from EPA on what we might expect in terms of this year's awardees?
Yeah, they're hoping to make that announcement on June 21st.
June
that doesn't 21st. Mean that it won't be delayed, but that's the date that they're hoping for right now.
So this year's grantees who are submitting, the RFP was delayed, they submitted earlier this year, we'll find out next week if they get the $200,000. We tend to encourage people to try to start programs with or without the EPA money because, as you know, grant money is great, but you have to figure out a way of sustaining yourself, and that's a tough one. Now, how does your program fund itself? Are you connected with a state organization?
Well, actually, it's what you said. Basically, it's almost a 100% federal funding, which I mean is it's a good and kind of a bad thing where it's great to have the money, but then at the same time you don't know if the money's going to be there the next year. And you are pretty limited in your scope of work. You can only really do what they permit you to do. We are pretty much basically all federal funded.
Oh, great. Is this tribal money or is it
it's our organization actually has a few programs, and we actually do have a Brownfields program. I don't know if my coworker is actually on the call. He might not be, but my position is the solid waste department manager, and my funding comes from the USDA and also from EPA hazardous waste management for tribes. And then our Brownfields, they have the typical or the regular Brownfields grant. We were actually looking at the environmental workforce grant, the one that it's a training grant. I think it falls under Brownfield, kind of.
Right, that's the one you're talking about. Yes. Mm-hmm.
The issue that we were looking at is that it seemed, as far as the requirements for the training, it seemed like there was so many trainings that you were required to give, and it just didn't seem with the amount of money to be very, I guess maybe feasible to hit, all the mandatory training.
Right. It's a tough grant, and what happens is the grant is the money comes from Office of Solid Waste Emergency Response, and Office of Water is involved, and Office of different offices have contributed money to this program, so they all want some training in their area. And what it really comes down to is, in that program, is they want you to pick. They want you first to do a needs assessment and find out,
right,
of course, where the jobs are, and then you want to focus your training on those jobs. But then what they want to do with all the other mandatory training is do basically awareness training. So, for example, now one thing you have to do, which you already do, is the HAZWOPR. That's a mandatory training.
Right.
After HAZWOPR, everything else is negotiable. You don't have to do anything else, except you do have to provide an awareness in all of those areas. So in other words, if you're in a community where there's a lot of lead, then you might be doing RRMP, and you might be doing asbestos, but then and then HAZWOPER, and then everything else might be put in one or two courses in terms of awareness. The meat and potatoes course, of course, for all of these environmental courses is the HAZWOPER.
Right.
Then after that, it's highly dependent and very highly dependent on where you think you can get jobs. Now, what community do you serve generally up there?
Well, actually, our area where we work is the Yukon River watershed. So we actually work with 53 tribes. And that's on the Alaska side. So I apologize. I'm not actually sure how many communities that is. I think it's 40 something.
So it's almost a statewide program. And
yeah, it's pretty close.
And heavy into water, wastewater, it sounds like.
Yeah, quite a bit.
We have been really suggesting wastewater is interesting because this year, and this is something you may want to consider in submitting a grant for the next round that would be in November of this year, water and wastewater is, I think they're recognizing that many people are retiring from that field. They came in the early 70s and they're all about ready to go. And they're finding that there's going to be a need for water, wastewater treatment people. And of course, in Alaska, you've got the watershed issues anyway,
right,
with the growth of industry and those issues. And it's an excellent topic area to concentrate in these brownfields, what they call environmental workforce. They used to be called the brownfields job training grants. Now it's environmental workforce and training program. But they're including water, wastewater issues in that. And but it is a restrictive program, and they give you a couple hundred thousand for 3 years, and they also require a placement rate of about 70%, and which is also tough. And now it's not a requirement; it's a guideline, and that kind of gets us into what one of the things we wanted to talk about today was the community. And a lot of people, sometimes we have many people on the call, sometimes less, and people may be joining us, but we will write post-session notes about this and have the recording. But when you think about your community, particularly in environmental job training grants, you're working primarily with tribal populations, but it is a question of, do you work with unemployed, do you work with veterans, do you work with disabled, do you work with ex-offenders, underemployed, do you focus with women? And so we've got job training programs who have really focused on just about each one of those. And some of them have a mixture of them, but sometimes more important issues that you have to address when you're looking at these programs, it may not be so much which population you're focusing on, whether it's disabled or veteran or ex-offenders, but it may be the level at which they're at. One of the biggest problems issues we have from instructors is when you get into a class and you've got this very divergent, you could have a diverse population of students, but really the more homogeneous the educational level is, the better your success rate is, because you're going to have to teach to the lowest level. So if you've got some people in that class who just are having difficulty and need remedial training, and then you've got some people who are really ready to go, it's a real challenge for your instructors of how do you teach to everyone to get them through. And so sometimes when we talk about recruiting and putting together your class, we can talk about your target group, but we also start having to talk about the academic level of those students. And there's other issues too. And you've got the academic level, which is a teaching issue. But you've got other things like entry skills. What are they bringing to them, to the class? For example, in a lot of our construction programs, a lot of the students have construction skills and they're very adept at using different types of tools, which if you're doing sampling or if you're doing wastewater treatment, you're going to find these students are very handy at jerry-rigging sampling devices and working out in the field, where you may have people who are just used to this and they've never worked with tools. So
yeah.
Those are issues. You've got issues with CDL. Many of our programs, some of our programs require everyone to get a commercial driver's license, and they actually include it as part of their program.
Wow.
If you've got someone who can't get a car or doesn't have a car or doesn't have a license, and in tribal issues, you may have that more than others. It could be a problem, particularly if your graduates have to go off-site and they have to drive quite a ways. Often, we found a lot of our tribal programs, the people in the tribe, and I don't know if you're seeing this, but they like to go to the construction job. They want to live on the reservation, but they don't mind going off to these jobs. I'm not sure if you're seeing that in your communities, but we've seen several tribes who said, that's okay, we can train, we can give them environmental skills, and they can get a job and go off for 3 months, but they want to live on the tribe, so they're coming back to the reservation, but they don't mind traveling, which can work in their favor, be a real positive. But you have other people who have families and really can't, and their structure of their family, they don't have the reservation experience. So what some people might say is a negative about reservation life, others may say a positive. They have reservations can be a home base for them, and they can go out and travel. They can go from Alaska down to Washington, or they might go to Hanford, or they might go down to California, but then they're going to come back to the reservation where you may have families in cities that have kids and really can't leave. So they're really relegated to day work. And so that becomes a real constraint in terms of your training. And, of course, these health issues. But it's interesting that we're pointing up all of these personal issues, but they really come back to the recruitment, because you don't want to recruit people and give them hopes in terms of, hey, we've got this great program, and you bring them all in and then find out that you're really not suited for this program, that actually the types of jobs that we're placing, you're not going to fit, or you can't drive, or you're an ex-offender, and the type of curriculum that we've set up is not going to allow you to work because they're not going to hire ex-offenders. We found some ways around that. There are many states for ex-offenders who have surety bonds, and the states will provide bonds for ex-offenders. But there are still some jobs that you're not going to be able to place them on. Now, there's other jobs that are very compatible to ex-offenders. Many in the construction fields are very compatible to ex-offenders. So that isn't necessarily a deal killer, but it's something you have to keep in mind. But this whole issue of remediation. Now, are you all focusing on pretty much unemployed people, or people who are in jobs and it's more incumbent training where you're upgrading their skills?
I would say mostly it's upgrading, capacity building for people who already have jobs. But at the same time, we don't turn away anyone if they're not employed, But I think our main focus is tribal employees.
Great. And so you're in a little better position than some of these grantees who their incoming classes are basically people who don't have jobs. And often the other issue is, do they have a way to sustain themselves through the training period? And in your case, if they've got jobs, they've got income. In some of these cases, they may not have the income, or they may not have daycare or something like that, and it makes it a big challenge.
Makes it difficult.
And of course, besides the criminal background is the drug issue, whether it's drugs or alcohol, it becomes an issue. And of course, all of our programs are drugs. They're all drug free. And most of them test, because The reason they'll do a test is that if they go to work somewhere, they'll do a test. So or
right.
they may do it. So they.
So you might as well do it now.
They do it now. Get it in. Get
yeah.
it in the program. Now we have a couple of programs who have said, when you finish this, before you finish the program, you will be drug free because there will be a test. We will be doing drug testing because you will not
yeah.
be able to do a job. But many of them just don't even consider people before they enter. Because again, it becomes you've got a lot of people who want to go into the programs, and it's they're tough programs, and
mm-hmm.
you lose some through the course of the program, and then of course you've got to place them. And when we look at universities and community colleges, we see that the dropout rate in many schools, universities range anywhere from 10 to 50%. Many of these schools, there are a few schools that the number of entries that actually graduate are in the low teens. And of course, some of your better
wow.
schools are up in the 90s. I think Duke is in about 94%. Robison Community College here in North Carolina is around 40%. We've seen community colleges range. Now, a lot of those people leave because they've got. Some have jobs, or there might be economic necessity, or that type of thing. But when you're thinking of recruiting, with those kind of dropout rates in universities, I'm sure you're probably confronted with the same thing of losing students. As they
oh yeah, that I mean that's a constant. It's a constant concern. We try to do our best with through our application process of. Making sure, I think our biggest issue is probably alcohol. We let people know, in the application and through speaking with them that it's drug and alcohol free. But, alcohol is a major issue in a lot of these small villages. And then, let's say our training's in Fairbanks, which is like the second, biggest town in Alaska. Some people come from these really small communities, and then they come to the city, and I think they might get kind of overwhelmed, and then, they fall into a kind of a pattern of going out and drinking and then not showing up for class, and then, you just spent all this time and effort, trying to train these people, and then, it just kind of falls apart a bit. So, yeah, I think alcohol and drugs are an issue that we face during our training.
Yeah. We and that's you're not alone. There's many with that. We found that some of the programs have done some interesting things in terms of their recruitment process. OAI, for example, in Chicago, they have tryouts, and they were recruiting. They had a federal program that was a urban gardening program, and they put out notices to the different groups around the city. And they actually had 1,000 preliminary interest applicants, and they had only about 100. 100 to 200 were going to go through this program. So the question is, how do you go from 1,000 to 100 or 200, and how do you vet these potential students? And what they did is they ran them through a series of kind of almost like tryouts. They had an open house, and then they had people come back for testing early in the morning, and of course they lost about half of the people right off the bat when all of a sudden they found out there was effort involved, and
right.
I have to actually get up early and I have to go take this test, and I'm not going to do that, all of a sudden they screened a lot of them there, and then as they went on through the interview process, they kept losing people. And because they just did not want to put up with all of this, and it's not worth it, and that type of thing. So they finally, they ran them through this kind of what they call tryout process to the point where they whittled it down to the people who were the most tenacious, that I'm going to go through this program if it kills me. And so they ended up with a really good group of people of around 100 to 200 or so. And then, of course, then you're still going to have some dropouts of people who might academically may not be able to hack it. They usually give them a TABE test to make sure that they're on a ninth grade level, that they can work with them to get them through the program, and then provide mm-hmm. them with whatever remediation training they need. But the big thing is that they know in that tryout process that they're drug-free. They know that they're willing. The big thing is they're willing to get up early. They're willing mm-hmm. to stick it through this program, which is really the hard part. And mm-hmm. we have a program in San Francisco which is almost run like a boot camp, and mm-hmm. they actually run them through the streets of San Francisco every morning. Huh. They start out real early. I mean, it is. They show up about, 5:30 or so. And
I might drop out of that.
It's tough. They run them through the neighborhood. We had a conference there several years ago, and the students came to the hotel. It was interesting because the hotel wouldn't have let them in the door. I don't know. It raised kind of a little bit of a ruckus, but they had been running through the streets, and they run through their community, and they're uh-huh. pretty much known in the community. Well, the beautiful thing about this is they always have more applicants than they could handle, and a lot of the recruitment actually comes from alumni and people in the program. It's, mm-hmm. it's like, this is a great program. It built my character. You know, I got a great job out of it. And so cousins and brothers and neighbors are going into it. And then, of course, the word gets out, if you're going to go in this program, you're going to bust your butt. And
right.
so the only people that do apply are people who are willing to do the hard work.
People are
work.
Serious.
So it's yeah. self-regulating, and it's a great way to vet people. We really don't encourage our grantees. The public agencies are okay, but they're mandated to pass people on, and those who are dependent on referrals from the WIB or Workforce Investment Boards, sometimes they have to be very careful in vetting their students because they don't necessarily. They could vet them for the drugs and the personnel for the CDL and the education, but that's that whole issue of desire that is the tough one. And, but we find that word of mouth, as you build up a program that's reoccurring year after year, like most of these programs are, your graduates mm-hmm. become your best recruiters, and they will bring students referral in your program. And of course, you've got to have your announcements of when your programs are going to be, and people realize they're going to be two or three times a year. And you're pretty regulated in when you can have your programs. You probably want to have your graduates out in early spring for mm-hmm. summer work, I expect. And so it's maybe even a little more challenge up where you're at.
Well, it's almost impossible to get anybody during the summer because, you know, quite a few of our tribal members, I mean, you know, they live a subsistence lifestyle. So when the fish are running, they're not available. And then, you know, during hunting season, they're not available. So you got to get them over the winter or early spring.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, it sounds like a great program you're working on. And, and I'm sure you've got your recruitment and training challenges, that's for sure. But mm-hmm. One of the things we do on these calls, we try to limit them to about 30 minutes, and we're going to have another one in 2 weeks. Whoever's on the call is on the call, and then the rest listen mm-hmm. on our tapes. And we'll send out some post-session notes about some of the things we talked about today and mm-hmm. some of the announcements that are coming up. And it was interesting to hear about your program. It sounds like you're doing some interesting things up there.
Oh yeah, well, you know, we try to, and we definitely encourage you to. You can go to our website, www.yritwc.org, there's a lot of different departments you can check out there. But also, I guess one of my main takeaways is so under the Environmental Workforce Training Grant. So it's the Hatchwhopper is, you know, the absolute must-do mandatory, but the other ones are more like
awareness.
Okay.
Awareness, and you could even you'd be stretching, but you could probably put it in one course. In other words, you can you the mandatory is the HAZWOPR. And we suggested and they accepted the fact that RRMP is not mandatory. RRMP is a lead. We argued with EPA, suggested to EPA that there are a lot of communities where lead isn't an issue, so it shouldn't be mandatory. So they basically agreed that the only one that's really necessary is the HAZWOPR. And then after that, they want you to talk about those other courses so that if the student was to run across asbestos or if someone mentions an innovative technology or if they mention some issue about
like underground storage tanks.
Right. They would know about it. They said, oh, yeah, I could tell you all about it. You've got an issue with plumes, and I know what a plume is and how the different ways we might treat a plume coming off an underground storage tank. So the whole issue is when they get to the job interview, we find that graduates of many of these programs, once they know the acronyms, all of a sudden people in the old days were recruiting them because now it's a little different because of the economic situation. But if they found if someone could speak the language and, oh, yeah, I know what that is and I know what a plume is and I know what these remediation technologies, well, and I've actually, I know how to or seen a test well drilled or whatever, or what a spectrometer is. It gives them such a jump, and of course, a lot of these programs will give them a series of certifications, whether it's confined space. Some give 10 or 15 certifications, and it's a way to get people employed because, well, HAZWOPR costs $600-$700, and of course, confined space $200, and what you could $200 or $300 on each of these adds up to some real money for for the employer. If I could find someone who's already got a list of these certifications, he's highly employable. But yeah, I would not let the what they seem to indicate as the mandatory. The key there is awareness in those other areas. I would not let that deter you from submitting an application next time around. And we'll be in these PLCs. We'll be through the fall and into the next season. When the applications come out, we kind of coach people on how they might go through the general criteria and then also the ranking criteria to make sure that they have a good shot at getting some of these grants. So
cool.
Keep in touch, and we'll make sure you're on our notes and list of announcements so that you'll be aware of these things. So.
All right.
Okay,
thank you very much.
We'll talk to you guys soon. Okay.
All right. Talk to you soon.
Bye.
Bye.